Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. On a previous episode, in March of 23, the theme was unrequited love, and I read poems by both men and women. This episode today considers unrequited love primarily from the woman's point of view. Guys in my audience, we need to listen in. Do women who experience an imbalance in their emotional connection with a partner express themselves differently than men do? Do they express more anger or more frustration than we might expect men to do? Can't Get Over Her by Ellen Bass was published in 2002. The opening line tells us the speaker is an aunt with a troubled nephew. This young man, from the aunt's point of view, has just begun to struggle to cross over to the world of adult relationships. He confides in his aunt regarding his unrequited love, and the aunt, the speaker of the poem, wonders whether she should tell her nephew that there's no way to erase his hurt feelings. To illustrate her attitude, she attempts to recover who she was when she was roughly his age. This is Ellen Bass's Can't Get Over Her. My nephew is distressed that he's still in love with the girl who went back to her boyfriend, the one who's not good enough for her. When he ran into her again, she had that same bright laugh, like the shine on an apple, and the wind rose, reaching up into the limbs and fluttering the leaves in the whole apple tree. But when she left, it hit him all over. She was headed for her boyfriend's house. She'd walk quickly in the brittle March night. He'd have a fire going. She'd unlace her boots and offer him her mouth, her lips still cold, velvet tongue warm in that satin cape. He didn't tell me all this, of course, but who hasn't longed for that girl, that boy? He's mad at himself that he can't get over her. He's young, and he's got goals, quit smoking, gave up weekend drunks. Now he tackles model airplane kits, one small piece at a time. He wants to learn mastery. Sweet man, should we tell him the truth? That he'll never get over her. Love is a rock in the surf off the Pacific. Life batters it. No matter how small it gets, it will always be there. Grain of sand, chafing the heart. I still love the boy who jockeyed cars expertly in the lots on New York Avenue, parking them so close he had to lift his lithe body out the window those sultry August afternoons. He smelled of something musky and rich, distinctive as redwoods in heat. I still long for him, like a patriot exiled from the motherland, a newborn switched in the hospital, raised in the wrong family. Each year that passes is one more I miss out on. His children are not mine. Even their new stepmother is not me. When she complains how hard she tries, how little they appreciate her, I think how much better off he'd be with me. And when he has grandchildren, they won't be mine either. And when he's dying, even if I go to him, I'll be little more than a dumb bouquet, spilling my scent. We don't get over any of it. The heart is stubborn and indefatigable and limitless. That's how I can turn to my beloved now, with the awe the early rabbis must have felt opening the Torah. And when she pulls me to her, still, after all these years, I feel like I did the first time I stood in front of Starry Night. I had never known, never imagined its life beyond the flat, smooth surface of the textbook, had never conceived there could be these thick swirls of paint, the rough-edged cobalt sky, the deep, spiraling valleys of starlight. Ellen Bass's Can't Get Over Her. The movement of this poem offers an abundance of riches. When the nephew encounters his former girlfriend, Her bright laugh reignites his desire for her. Her bright laugh is like the shine on an apple. Well, that's a straightforward simile. But the poet extends the comparison to indicate how carried away her nephew was. Quotes, "And the wind rose, reaching up into the limbs and fluttering the leaves in the whole apple tree." And when her nephew parts from his former girlfriend, despair sets in. The aunt imagines that her nephew creates a scene of the young woman being greeted at home by her current boyfriend. He'd have a fire going, she'd unlace her boots and offer him her mouth, her lips still cold, velvet tongue warm in that satin cape. The aunt then admits, well, he did not explicitly say this, but she presumes we could all imagine the hurt he feels. The aunt wholeheartedly empathizes with her nephew. "Sweet man," she calls him affectionately. And when we're nearly halfway into the poem, the speaker winks at her reader, or even puts her arm around her reader and asks, "Should we tell him the truth?" The speaker presumes we've all experienced the unhappiness of unrequited love, and that we all know we never really age out of that sense of loss. For the second half of the poem, the speaker develops a most personal analogy. Though it was many decades ago, she still calls to mind, even still longs for, a certain young man, his lithe body, his scent musky and rich, distinctive as redwoods in heat. She does not recall this young man's kindness or the way he laughed, but his looks and his scent, they flood her mind decades later. The speaker risks sounding comical by asserting she has missed out on the fullness of a life with this guy and the family they could have shared. "I think how much better off he'd be with me." Apparently, she has no information on what happened to him. She conjures up his whole extended family and tries to picture herself as part of it. This poem doubles down on the unrequited love theme. She empathizes with her nephew, for whom the experience is brand new, and she ponders what could have been if her own relationship with the boy who jockeyed cars continued for a decade. Thoughts of this young man who got away from her leave the speaker with no ability to console her nephew. "We don't get over any of it," she asserts in her penultimate stanza. But the poem refuses to conclude with self-pity. Instead, the final two stanzas return us to the present and the speaker's current most satisfying love experience. Perhaps because she's known unrequited love, her current love life is even more satisfying. Let's hear this poem once more from her 2002 volume, Mules of Love. This is Can't Get Over Her by Ellen Bass. My nephew is distressed that he's still in love with the girl who went back to her boyfriend, the one who's not good enough for her. When he ran into her again, she had that same bright laugh, like the shine on an apple, and the wind rose, reaching up into the limbs and fluttering the leaves in the whole apple tree. But when she left, it hit him all over. She was headed for her boyfriend's house. She'd walk quickly in the brittle March night. He'd have a fire going. She'd unlace her boots and offer him her mouth, her lips still cold, velvet tongue warm in that satin cape. He didn't tell me all this, of course, but who hasn't longed for that girl, that boy? He's mad at himself that he can't get over her. He's young, and he's got goals. Quit smoking. Gave up weekend drunks. Now he tackles model airplane kits, one small piece at a time. He wants to learn mastery. Sweet man, should we tell him the truth? That he'll never get over her. Love is a rock in the surf off the Pacific. Life batters it. No matter how small it gets, it will always be there, grain of sand chafing the heart. I still love the boy who jockeyed cars expertly in the lots on New York Avenue, parking them so close he had to lift his lithe body out the window those sultry August afternoons. He smelled of something musky and rich, distinctive as redwoods in heat. I still long for him, like a patriot exiled from the motherland, a newborn switched in the hospital, raised in the wrong family. Each year that passes is one more I miss out on. His children are not mine. Even their new stepmother is not me. When she complains how hard she tries, how little they appreciate it, I think how much better off he'd be with me. And when he has grandchildren, they won't be mine either. And when he's dying, even if I go to him, I'll be little more than a dumb bouquet, spilling my scent. We don't get over any of it. The heart is stubborn and indefatigable, and limitless. That's how I can turn to my beloved now, with the awe the early rabbis must have felt opening the Torah. And when she pulls me to her, still, after all these years, I feel like I did the first time I stood in front of Starry Night. I had never known, never imagined its life beyond the flat, smooth surface of the textbook, had never conceived there could be these thick swirls of paint, the rough-edged cobalt sky, the deep, spiraling valleys of starlight. That the speaker's current love is another woman won't come as a big surprise to those familiar with other poems by Ellen Bass. Nevertheless, the poem's movement as it approaches closure may startle us. The difference between what she imagined her love life could be and what she now actually enjoys is like the difference between seeing a photo of Van Gogh's Starry Night in a book and viewing the original up close. The vividness of the colors, the texture of the paint strokes, you have to experience it to know it. This, the speaker implies, is requited love. The speaker could have gone full circle and told her nephew, "You too, I trust, will eventually enjoy such happiness." But direct advice might seem patronizing, like head patting. She leaves her lesson implicit. Often, when poets write of unrequited love, jealousy makes an appearance. The speaker's nephew feels certain his former girlfriend is now with a guy who, the poem says, is not good enough for her. And when the speaker concocts the life that may have unfolded for the musky-smelling car jockey boy she desired decades earlier, she concludes, "I think how much better off he'd be with me." If we travel back over 2,500 years, we find evidence of jealousy at the core of some poetic fragments written by Sappho. She lived on the Greek island of Lesbos, and Sappho's poetic fragments suggest a primarily all-female communal world. We know that she is the only ancient Greek female author whose work survived, and we know the name of her home island morphed into the term lesbian during the 19th century. Beyond that, Sappho's historical context remains uncertain. For example, what did her contemporaries think about the same-sex desires her poems express? Let's first visualize the situation depicted in Sappho's fragment of a poem, number 31. We focus on a man seated next to a woman with a lovely laugh. Then, let's imagine, the camera pulls back and we see an extended reaction shot of a second woman who is jealous of the man. Her physical response to the laughing woman nearly overwhelms her. This is Sappho's Fragment Number 31. How can I compete with that damned man who fancies himself one of the gods, impressing you with his eloquence, when just the thought of sitting in your radiant presence, of hearing your lovely voice and lively laughter, sets my heart hammering at my breast? Hell, when I catch just a quick glimpse of you, I'm left speechless, tongue-tied, and immediately a blush like a delicate flame reddens my skin. Then my vision dims with tears, my ears ring, I sweat profusely, and every muscle in my body trembles. When the blood finally settles, I grow paler than summer grass, till, in my exhausted madness, I'm as limp as the dead. And yet I must risk all, being bereft without you. This version of Sappho's Fragment Number 31 is by Michael Birch, who labels it a loose translation interpretation because he's working with fragments and filling in gaps in phrasing, creating a smooth movement, a coherent flow to the poem that the fragments, if translated alone, do not reveal. We don't get any background information on the man with an inflated ego who thinks he's godlike, nor do we get any background on the woman sitting next to the man and profoundly desired by the speaker. There is a wonderful connection with Ellen Bass's poem. There, the young nephew's desire for his former girlfriend is rekindled when he hears her bright laugh. Sappho's speaker refers to the lively laughter of the object of her desire. Did you fall in love with the person whose laugh appeals? Is the opposite true? Would you find it hard to love someone whose laugh annoyed you? But Sappho's poem's focus is not primarily on the speaker's object of desire. Instead, it's on the speaker's own violent sensations when in the presence of the woman she desires. She even describes what she cannot see, her own blushes. The speaker does not claim she's being rational. She knows she's overwhelmed by an exhausted madness. This is the opposite of an out-of-the-body experience. This speaker can't control her bodily responses when in the presence of her object of desire, especially when that object has turned her attention to another, and to a man, no less. Let's hear Michael Birch's translation of this Sappho Fragment Number 31 again. How can I compete with that damned man who fancies himself one of the gods, inspiring you with his eloquence, when just the thought of sitting in your radiant presence, of hearing your lovely voice and lively laughter, sets my heart hammering at my breast? Hell, when I catch just a quick glimpse of you, I'm left speechless, tongue-tied, and immediately a blush like a delicate flame reddens my skin. Then my vision dims with tears, my ears ring, I sweat profusely, and every muscle in my body trembles. When the blood finally settles, I grow paler than summer grass, till in my exhausted madness I'm as limp as the dead. And yet I must risk all, being bereft without you. In this translation, there's an ellipsis, a dot, 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 after the final line. And yet, I must risk all, being bereft without you, dot, dot, dot. The ellipsis emphasizes the open-endedness of the speaker's feelings. What will she risk? Will she attempt to persuade the other woman to turn her attention away from the man and toward herself? The quality of this fragment is enhanced by that uncertainty. Sharon Olds' 2012 book, Stag's Leap, a post-divorce volume, earns its place as an extreme testament to unrequited love. In the poem Crazy, Sharon Olds' speaker puzzles over these implicit questions. Was there an imbalance in her marriage? Were she and her husband both crazy for each other? If not, how did they manage to stay together for decades? I don't detect any hint of jealousy in the poem I will read, which distinguishes Crazy from Ellen Bass's Can't Get Over Her and Sappho's lyrics. This is Sharon Olds' poem, Crazy. I've said that he and I have been crazy for each other, but maybe my ex and I were not crazy for each other. Maybe we were sane for each other, as if our desire was almost not even personal. It was personal, but that hardly mattered, since there seemed to be no other woman or man in the world. Maybe it was an arranged marriage. Air and water and earth had planned us for each other. And fire, a fire of pleasure, like a violence of kindness. To enter those vaults together, like a solemn or laughing couple in formal step or writhing hair and cry, seemed to me like the earth's and moon's paths, inevitable, and even, in a way, shy, enclosed in a shyness together, equal in it. But maybe I was crazy about him. It is true that I saw that light around his head when I'd arrived second at a restaurant. Oh, for God's sake, I was besotted with him. Meanwhile, the planets orbited each other. The morning and the evening came. And maybe what he had for me was unconditional, temporary affection and trust, without romance, though with fondness, with mortal fondness. There was no tragedy for us. There was the slow, revealed comedy of ideal and error. What precision of action it had taken for the bodies to hurtle through the sky for so long without harming each other. Sharon Olds' speaker wrestles with her post-mortem on her marriage in Crazy. The opening sentence alerts us to her honesty. I've said that he and I have been crazy for each other, but maybe my ex and I were not crazy for each other. We can guess that the speaker has offered to others explanations for the collapse of her marriage. She may have said that the divorce stunned her because she thought they were mutually crazy for one another. But over time, with some distance from the marriage, she's revised her previous explanation. Now she recognizes distinctions between how she looked on her husband and how he looked on her. Though Olds would not be so crass as to say this, it's almost as though the speaker's ex steered his life with his emotions on cruise control. This sudden revelation does not anger the speaker. She might be wondering, why didn't I recognize this a long time ago? Sharon Olds had been married for 30 years and divorced for 10 when she published her volume Stag's Leap in 2012. Does her poem suggest that maybe she did not know her husband as well as we might presume, considering they were married for 3 decades? Does she express gratitude towards him? Any shame about herself? More than halfway through the poem, the speaker scolds herself. Oh, for God's sake, I was besotted with him. The speaker continues, and maybe what he had for me was unconditional, temporary affection and trust without romance, though with fondness, with mortal fondness. Belatedly, she admits there was a stunning emotional imbalance in her marriage. There was neither mutual craziness nor mutual sanity in how they viewed each other. The word besotted jumps off the page for me, blindly swept away, irrationally infatuated. There's danger with such a passion. Crazy closes with the speaker evaluating how they lasted together for so long with such an imbalance. Let's hear again Sharon Old's Crazy. I've said that he and I have been crazy for each other, but maybe my ex and I were not crazy for each other. Maybe we were sane for each other, as if our desire was almost not even personal. It was personal, but that hardly mattered since there seemed to be no other woman or man in the world. Maybe it was an arranged marriage. Air and water and earth had planned us for each other. And fire, a fire of pleasure, like a violence of kindness. To enter those vaults together, like a solemn or laughing couple in formal step or writhing hair and cry, seemed to me like the earth's and moon's paths, inevitable and even, in a way, shy, enclosed in a shyness together, equal in it. But maybe I was crazy about him. It is true that I saw that light around his head when I'd arrived second in a restaurant. Oh, for God's sake, I was besotted with him. Meanwhile, the planets orbited each other. The morning and the evening came, and maybe what he had for me was unconditional, temporary affection and trust, without romance, though with fondness, with mortal fondness. There was no tragedy for us. There was the slow revealed comedy of ideal and error. What precision of action it had taken for the bodies to hurtle through the sky for so long without harming each other. Midway through the poem, the speaker notes that as a couple, they were enclosed in a shyness together, equal in it. Somehow, this married couple in Crazy, as the final line asserts, managed for the duration of their shy marriage to avoid harming each other. The final sentence, what precision of action it had taken for the bodies to hurtle through the sky for so long without harming each other. Other episodes on the provocative theme of unrequited love will soon follow. I need to grant equal time to men's responses. Our theme music is by Philip Auberg. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company.